Live from Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. On August 30th, officials ordered residents of South Lake Tahoe to evacuate as flames and embers from the Caldor fire drew near. Photos from late August and early September show just how hazy and dark the usually blue skies were in the Tahoe Basin. Cap Radio had reporters at the ready, providing you with the latest updates as we watched and waited to see what could become of the beloved destination. We've been experiencing catastrophic fires for years now. In 2020, an estimated record of about 4.3 million acres burned in California, and this year is rivaling that number. Cap Radio's data reporter, Emily Zentner, and KQED's climate reporter, Ezra David Romero, worked together to learn what worked to keep Tahoe protected from the Caldor fire. Emily and Ezra join us now to share their reporting. Welcome both to Insight. Oh, you're muted. The days when we don't have to do Zoom anymore, right? How's it going, Emily?
Good. How are you?
Doing great. Well, you both worked on the Tahoe Land podcast. What drew you to reporting on the basin?
Well, I actually grew up in the Sierra in a tiny town along I-80. And so we spent a lot of time in Tahoe growing up. And I have a lot of affection for that area and a lot of memories there. And it's also just a really unique community and ecosystem. And it's a place that a lot of people care about and have a really strong connection to. So I think it's a really good place to look at some of these larger issues like climate change and forest management, because, you know, people care about it and people know the area and people want to see it preserved.
Well, given your perspective and your journalism, just your passion reporting on the Tahoe area, when the Caldor fire was happening, how were you feeling? What was going through your mind as a journalist and also just as a person?
I mean, having done this reporting 2 years ago, it was just really, I don't know if shocking is the right word, because we all kind of know the reality of the situation we're living in, but it was really just affecting to like think about, all of this reporting we'd done and see that actually happening and see some of this preparation that we'd been talking to people about having to go into use. And wondering if these communities were going to make it through the fire. It was really affecting.
Ezra, what stood out to you over the years as you visited and reported on Tahoe?
Yeah, well, I grew up going to Tahoe because my grandparents lived in Reno and Carson City. So it was like a twice a year spot for us. And so it's iconic, right? Like the view of Lake Tahoe, that cerulean blue ocean in the sky, you know, it's peaceful and I love it there. But like as a reporter, you know, I've been a climate reporter for about 9 years now. And then when I got to Cap Radio, we wanted to do a podcast or a series about a place that had a lot of science going on. And Tahoe is a place that's studied really well in the Sierra Nevada. There's tons of science around climate change all happening there. And so by doing that work and doing that podcast Tahoe Land that we did, you know, we just understood that Tahoe is changing. It's growing in popularity and impacts from wildfire to a greening lake. All these things are all happening in tandem. So it's iconic, but it's also changing.
I would imagine, just given that there's nostalgia and your childhood is attached to Tahoe, but you're also a journalist looking into climate change and you're an environmental reporter. When you were reporting on the Caldor fire, there must be some type of compartmentalization that happens to you as a journalist and also just as a person.
Yeah, I mean, I think in some way, you know, we're humans and we're journalists, experience these things at the same time. And, you know, climate change is a worldwide phenomenon, right? So I found that reporting on the Caldor fire was interesting because I was also allowed to like be myself and like react as a human experiencing this, but also as a journalist reporting on this. It's sort of like people who are reporting on Black Lives Matter or things like that. If you're a person of color, you're also part of the story and you can insert yourself in it because you are part of it. And so it's similar with climate change. You know, we are part of the story. And it's happening to us as well, and the places we love.
Yeah. Well, you both spoke with climate scientists a few years ago about how wildfire conditions in Tahoe will get worse, and now we're here. What did they have to say watching the Caldor fire?
The scientist I talked to was kind of taken aback. We knew this could happen and we knew this would happen, but having it be here right now was, you know, was just a different ball game. And the scientist I talked to, Ben Hatchett with the Desert Research Institute in Reno, you know, he was talking to us in Tahoe land about these things happening by the end of the century. So seeing it happen right now was kind of, you know, like a moment to step back and be like, we have to think about this differently. And he is really hoping that because Tahoe is so iconic, like Ezra and I have been talking about, that the Caldor fire kind of spurs people into some action so that we can prevent things from happening like this in the future. And here's Ben.
I think there needs to be a ton more rapid adaptation. I really hope this Tahoe is, because everyone knows and loves it, I really hope it is the wake-up call of like, okay, we all need to get together and put aside these historic issues and figure out what we're going to do so that it's not Tahoe City next year or Truckee next year.
Yeah. And when I talk to people in Tahoe, that same sentiment about a wake-up call, everyone from like the mayor of the city to residents there, to fire people, they're all talking about how like the impacts of climate change are here now. And then, you know, in that podcast, we gave this like hypothetical scene of what climate change would look like in the year 2099. When I talked to the mayor pro tem there, Devin Middlebrook, he was like, Ezra, like that happened 2 years later, not 80 years later. So I think they're all talking about how adaptation needs to happen now.
Right. And Emily, I mean, there's just so many factors that go into this. And you spoke with a climate scientist about the compounding effects of drought and constant heat waves that we've been experiencing here. What did you learn about this?
Yeah, I mean, it's a cycle and a system, and the drought and the heat waves that we're dealing with, you know, when we think about how that's fueling fire, it's just drying everything out and everything is just ready to go when one of these fires starts. And that we have these conditions that maybe a climate scientist predicted happening in like 20 years or 80 years, like Ezra was saying, but we can't really predict nature with any kind of exactitude. And so these things can happen all at once. And that's kind of what we saw with the Caldor fire, was we saw a lot of things converging at once to create this really devastating situation. And what Ben Hatchett had to say about that is that with climate science, they take a long lens, but we need to be ready for this to happen right now.
We try to approximate nature, but she is very difficult. And combining that with such a push for, you know, the end of the century by this point, and like the work we do in climate projections to inform adaptation and vulnerability assessments, I usually push the idea of like, okay, here's, you know, what's going to happen in the mid-century, the end of century, but you should probably plan for the worst to happen next year.
Yeah, and I talked to some scientists who did some recent studies who talked about how like over the past four decades, fires in the Sierra Nevada or in mountains across the West have gone up by 25 feet every year in elevation. And that's happened in concentration in the Sierra Nevada area more than anywhere else. So it sort of made sense that a fire like the Caldor would happen in a place like Tahoe.
Yeah. And you look at the Caldor fire and the Dixie fire. I mean, they were both unprecedented in that they both crested over the Sierra Nevada, and that hasn't happened before. So when it comes to those realities, what are climatologists hoping we can do if we can't accurately predict what's going to happen?
Yeah, I mean, we know with some degree of certainty what our climate future looks like if we don't change things. We know these increasing wildfires, but we don't know when that's going to happen. And I posed kind of a dark question to Ben Hatchett, which was, you know, looking at, like you were saying, the Caldor fire and the Dixie fire and these just really shocking and catastrophic fires, are we at a point where we could improve the situation with climate and wildfire, or do we just need to adapt to it? And he said that we're at a point now where there's a lot of damage that we can't undo that's already been done to the climate. But if we start working on treating forests and taking climate action now, we can create a less dire future, but it's still going to be warmer and we're still going to have, you know, intense wildfires.
We're not going to stop that train, but we might be able to divert it so that instead of taking out like the downtown area, maybe it just like runs into, you know, the warehouse or something.
Right.
And I guess in Tahoe, that's all about climate adaptation, right? We're at a place there that these fires can happen any year at any time. Things are getting so dry. Like this past year, right, the fires crested the Sierra Nevada. And, you know, we're in a place where communities have to adapt. And that's what Tahoe is doing. And we saw that with wildfire this year.
Yeah. Well, Emily, I mean, you and Ezra, you both spoke with Donna Ray Reynolds and Patty Wheeler when they planned an evacuation drill for their very own neighborhood, Golden Bear. When were they planning these drills? Because it obviously was great being this proactive.
Yeah, they planned this drill in like spring 2019, and Ezra and I went there, and it was pretty remarkable. They had the fire department involved. They sent out, you know, the evacuation alerts on their phones and were really interested in getting their neighborhood talking about how they would handle this. And they kept talking to us about this next big fire. And the morning that the Caldor fire was approaching South Lake Tahoe, I went back and read that story and was kind of like, wow, this is that next big fire. And, you know, their big thing then and now is just making sure that they have that communication worked out and are ready to go.
So, you know, nearly 2 years later, how did it work out on evacuation day in August?
So their neighborhood, Golden Bear, got advanced warning the night before the evacuation. They got the warning, and then the sheriff's office came around and gave them a heads up. So, you know, we can't undersell the importance of that early notification so that they can get through that. But I think partially because they knew this was a reality and they had done some things beforehand, they had their important items where they needed them to be. It was really calm and they were just able to get out and, you know, kind of get in their cars and wave at each other and, you know, just get going and get to safety.
So when the mandatory came on Monday morning around 9, we just all simply got in our cars and waved to each other and we took off, and there was no traffic coming through South Lake Tahoe for us.
You know, Ezra, you were in Tahoe during those evacuations. What were the experiences of the people that you spoke with?
They were varied, you know, but the thing is that people knew the fire was coming for 2 weeks. They saw the smoke, it was coming across the Sierra Nevada. So a lot of people were prepared. Others weren't as prepared, but there was a big evacuation warning 5 to 6 hours ahead of time, and people got out.
Emily, how much of what's fueling these really catastrophic fires is due to overgrown forests, and how much of it is climate change?
Basically, we have these really overgrown forests that are just getting baked in heat wave after heat wave, and then they're nice and crispy and ready to burn when something like this happens. And one scientist Ezra talked to said he saw it as like 75% forest management and 25% climate change, because when we have these overgrown forests, climate change is just like throwing gasoline on an already bad situation. So we have to look at the two together.
Yeah, I mean, that's a pretty good analogy. Ezra, when it comes to Tahoe and fire prevention, what makes that area unique? What made it possible for South Lake Tahoe to evade really the worst case scenario during the Caldor fire?
Yeah, it's really two things: wildfire prevention and then all the, like the all out firefight that happened, you know, that night when the fire came over Echo Summit. You know, firefighters fought from house to protect them. But what also made that possible was there's like 65,000 acres of the Tahoe Basin that's been treated with like forest thinning, where they go in thin forests or they burn them on purpose in prescribed burns. And the fire crew said that when the fire was coming down at like 150, 200 feet high, when it reached those treated areas, it fell to 20 feet. And so that made it really easy for these firefighters, not easy, but it made it easier for these firefighters to contain the fire around these homes and to save South Lake Tahoe. They also put trenches in. And so it's like this mixture of like an all-out firefight, some luck, and this firework that they've done in the past.
You know, we only have a few seconds, but I'm just curious with your perspective, Ezra, were you surprised at how really relatively successful it was?
Yeah, I mean, that night I was like staring at Twitter, watching the fire come down in the basin, and it seemed like the fire could have easily gotten into Tahoe. You know, these, they were embers flying a mile ahead of the fire. So I think they did all this work, but I think at the end of the day, there's a huge amount of luck as well that went into this.
Ezra and Emily, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
And that is CAP Radio's data reporter, Emily Zentner, and KQED's climate reporter, Ezra David Romero, who worked together to learn what worked to keep Tahoe protected from the Caldor fire. Up next, a human ecologist, Grade Sacramento, on how it balances the relationship between people and the environment. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. All this week, CAP Radio has been sharing findings from a poll to better understand Sacramento area residents' relationship to food. Residents across Sacramento's six-county region were surveyed, encompassing Sacramento, Yolo, El Dorado, Placer, Yuba, and Sutter counties. This is an ongoing collaboration with CAP Radio, the nonprofit Valley Vision, and Sacramento State's Institute for Social Research, which also had intriguing findings about residents' views about open space. More than 90% of people who responded to the poll in the six-county region said they felt strongly that land should be preserved for wild animals and plants. And a similar percentage of people felt the same about protecting farmland. So we invited UC Davis Assistant Professor Haven Kears on the show to get a reaction to the survey and tell us her ideas about how to design urban landscapes with open space in mind. Welcome to the show, Professor Kears.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Excited to have you. First of all, can you break down what human ecology is?
Oh, that's the tricky one. So human ecology is basically the study of people, places, and power. And I fall more into the places part. And so I'm a professor primarily of landscape architecture. And so design of places.
What attracted you into this field?
So I have always loved the idea of design. I've always just loved nature. I mean, it if you see these poles, I mean, it's really obvious that this is a connection that we all have. And so the ability to be able to create spaces for people that involved nature, where you could have both of those together, just has always intrigued me. And I love being able to do that.
Are you surprised by the overwhelming desire among Sacramento area residents for open wild spaces? And I mean, we're talking about six counties here.
Yeah, not at all. I mean, I actually am teaching a first year seminar here at Davis that's called Nature RX, and it's all about the healing power of nature. And really what all of this research shows is that spending time in nature makes us happier, it reduces stress, it reduces loneliness, and it fosters social connections. And so people really feel this connection to nature, and they need to be a part of it. And so, of course, that means creating more open spaces and having spaces for people to be able to go out into. And we really saw that during the pandemic.
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, even for me, I'm from Los Angeles, and moving to Sacramento was just a gem. I mean, walking among so many trees and being surrounded by rivers and even farmland, that's what, like a 15, 20 minute drive away. I mean, it really is wonderful for your mental health.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Even if it is, I mean, studies have shown that just looking at nature, I mean, it's just passive viewing can even help. And so being able to have these riverfront parks and neighborhood parks, and then the beauty of this area is that we are really, if you can have access to transportation, you've got Tahoe, you've got the coast, you've got so many pristine, I mean, in quotes, wilderness areas.
So how do you think overall the Sacramento area is doing in terms of preserving wild open spaces? I mean, given you're a professor, I mean, if there's a grade here, what grade would you give our area?
So, I mean, I think I'd give Sacramento a solid B. I think that if you think about it, with all of, as I was saying, that riverfront access, thinking about like the agriculture space and the hedgerows and the efforts that people have been making to incorporate like salmon within the rice fields and bird preserves and all of that, And as I said, also the accessibility to surrounding wildness. I mean, I think it's a B, even listening to myself talk. I mean, I'll go up to a B plus. I think it's there.
Well, how could our area be better to get to that, you know, A minus A?
Well, so this is kind of where I think that good design and planning comes in. And so much of it is, it's really hard to create pure wild areas. And I mean, even our wilderness is human altered. And so we do have so much of our land, I mean, especially in the Sacramento metro area, is either suburban or urban areas. And so the focus of my work is to take these spaces and, you know, actually try and rewild them. And I don't mean that in the kind of way where we're, you know, bringing in all sorts of crazy wildlife and like bring back the bears or anything like that. But I mean, starting to think about putting native plants in place instead of having lawns that are just straight turf or sod, thinking about what are some native alternatives that are also drought tolerant so that you can have, you know, you can still be sustainable, you can create habitat for wildlife. So wild and native insects need to have co-evolved with wild and native plants. So you want to bring that in. So creating these pockets of biodiversity within the urban areas, within those suburban areas. So like, for example, one of the projects I'm working on is, it's called the Seed Pile Project. And I'm working on that with a local landscape company called Miraday and their nonprofit Miraday Living Labs. And what we're doing is we're taking native seeds, so local ecotypes of seeds that naturally grow within our area, and we're giving them away to people for free. And the idea is that they can take those seeds and all they need to do is put them in a little pile in an area near their house. So back alley, open vacant lot, a hill strip between areas, in a median along the highway. And then we're asking them to monitor it. And we want to see what are the native plants that can grow without maintenance, without a lot of care, and that can then bring in that biodiversity. So those are the types of projects that I'm really interested in.
Wow. I mean, that's great. I mean, it's almost like rewilding spaces within urban and suburban areas.
And that's exactly what I'm trying to do, because we can't separate so that it's just human land and wilderness land. There's always going to be a combination of the two. And so the question is, how can you reconcile them so that the two can actually cohabitate happily? And how can you do so where you're bringing in these plants and you're bringing back birds and insects and all of these things that we need, you know, for successful ecosystems, but to do it in a way that looks good, right? Again, this is the designer in me. How do you make it pretty so that it doesn't look like it's just this crazy messy thing and we're just like throwing seeds everywhere? It's the seeds that we're using, for example, are all flowering forbs. They're all native annuals that are beautiful wildflowers. So how can you create these spaces that are engaging for people, that give people the open space, right, that they need and that we're talking about, but that also create those nooks for the habitat?
Yeah, and we're talking about native plants, but when it comes to wildlife, how do you create space for wildlife within cities and within suburbs?
Well, it depends on the kind of wildlife that you're talking about. I mean, if we're talking about, again, like the bears, then that's going to be a little trickier.
Right.
If we're talking about some of the, you know, a lot, the birds is a great example. Thinking about if you're, again, that's putting in native plants, bringing in the native insects that then the birds eat so that you can bring in tons of birds that way. You know, there's some amazing projects right now with the rice fields and ag plans where they're actually bringing back salmon and they're using the rice fields to rear salmon in there. So there are ways where you can actually take some of this wildlife and work within that human system to bring them back successfully.
Yeah, I've actually been out there and have seen rice farmers, you know, working alongside ecologists to help salmon. And because obviously the salmon population, many of the runs are in a dire state here in California. How is it different when you're looking at farmlands compared to cities and suburbs, making spaces more hospitable to wildlife and plants?
I mean, I think with the farmlands, a lot of the things, like a lot of what you want to think about are the edges and the, and along the different farmlands. So something like hedgerows are super important for wildlife. And it's a way, so no one's saying like take over the ag space and put in wildlife there, but it's saying, okay, along these edges between fields or as a windbreak, instead of just putting in a row of poplar trees, let's instead create these niches and layers of native plants that have shrubs for the, that have berries for the birds, that have nectar and pollen for the native bees, so that that create like little hiding spaces for rabbits, for the animals that are out there in the fields, ground nesting birds. So that you have, you can start to create corridors through the fields, and it's not just hand of man right there in the center and that's it. It's really, again, reconciling the two and creating spaces that can kind of work together.
Given that this is your wheelhouse, so your perspective is geared towards this, and it allows you to think outside the box and be creative with, for example, giving seeds to residents for free and just having them throw them in their alleyway and try to grow native plants. How do you get city leaders to kind of look at things in the same way when it comes to planning for open land preservation and for really rewilding urban spaces?
That's a really good question. I think so much of it is really based on relationships and building relationships with people. This is the one thing, especially working, you know, in a university where it's all about the bureaucracy, it's meeting the people, speaking with the people. But I think the other thing is capturing people's imagination. So for example, one of the projects that I'm working on here at the university is a sheep mowing project. And so we're actually using sheep to do some of the maintenance of the lawns. And the way I was able to convince people about that was this idea that, okay, it's creating a pastoral landscape and it's creating a space where people can engage with the animals. And so granted, these aren't wild animals, but it is bringing animals into the urban environment. And so that's just been a constant sort of negotiation with people. And so getting people excited about the potential and what it looks like. And again, as a designer, showing pretty pictures, right? So this is what it could look like. This is how it's kind of a combination of, you know, showing what the potential is and how it's beautiful, and then being able to convince people that it can be maintained, because that's going to be a huge part of it as well.
What I also thought was pretty interesting was in the survey, preservation of open space for plants and animals, as well as regional farmland, were consistently ranked higher when compared to building new housing, as well as commercial and retail areas. What does that tell you?
What it says is that we really value this nature, and that we understand that we need housing, but that maybe we are getting closer to thinking about putting housing in more dense areas, or taking the housing that we have and really adding nature to it, right? There are two different ways of looking at it, either like really creating sort of that dense urban core and preserving open space, or trying to find the balance between it and saying, okay, if we've got this need for open space, how do we insert that? And how do we plan for that in new housing development? How do we create green belts and bioswales and incorporate the sort of green infrastructure that can work hand in hand with the building environment?
Last question. I mean, this kind of goes alongside our previous segment when talking about the Caldor fire and climate change. Roughly 75% of respondents said that they were either very concerned or somewhat concerned about climate threats. How does this factor into the conversation of creating open space within urban and suburban areas?
I think it's really important to think about how, you know, where the fires are happening and what's going on. Like the fires are happening in that weird, like wildland urban interface, right? Where you've got that mixture of, say, housing and development and wildlife. And so that's that area really that I'm talking about, where it's saying we need to focus on that area. We can't just focus on the urban area, and we can't just focus on rural and farmland. We really need to think about that in-between area and how do we design so that you can have that open space, but is fire safe and creates space between houses, but that also because the development is going to continue to happen. So it's really about figuring out how to combine the two successfully.
Haven, thanks so much for joining us. I really appreciated the conversation. It was a lot of fun.
That's great. I had fun too. Thank you.
And that is Haven Kears, a UC Davis assistant professor, sharing ideas about how to design urban landscapes with open space in mind. Still ahead, the Aftershock Festival returns to Sacramento with jam-packed headliners rocking out over the weekend. We'll share the highlights and the overdue excitement after pausing the festival last year. You can also join the conversation. Email us at insight@capradio.org or use the Twitter hashtag AskInsight. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment. Welcome back to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. You know what doesn't go so well with social distancing? Moshing, large crowds, shoulder to shoulder, jumping and headbanging in unison to the eruption of heavy metal, rock music, and throwback hip hop. Well, we have turned a loud corner. Sacramento is preparing for its largest event since the pandemic. The Aftershock Festival kicks off tonight, runs through Sunday, after pausing last year due to the pandemic. Initially, I thought this was a sold-out festival, but good news, there are single-day tickets still available. Joining us with the highlights and some FAQs for those heading to downtown this weekend is Shami McCurry, Chief Marketing Officer with Aftershock Festival. Welcome to Insight.
Thank you for having me.
Well, the months leading up obviously were uncertain. Can you just kind of lead us through this uncertain journey of planning a festival of this magnitude?
I mean, the last year and a half have been uncertain.
Right.
But specifically in the last months, you know, about 3 months ago when we felt incredibly confident that we were going to be able to have this event this year, you know, we really, really focused in on how can we do it as safe as possible when we're talking about an event of this magnitude. And, you know, that was when we worked with the city and the local health departments on coming up with a COVID plan that now has become industry standard, which is, you know, the proof of vaccination or a negative test result within 72 hours of coming on site. So that really is, you know, something that we have been communicating to our fans to get them here as safely as possible to ensure, you know, the future in 2022 and beyond.
So how are you feeling the day of the first night?
It's exciting. You know, I think all of us realized a few months into, you know, the shutdown, how much we truly missed live events and how much we needed that release of connecting with, you know, our fellow humans, with our favorite artists, listening to our favorite song. And so to finally be here 2 years after we announced two nights of Metallica, you know, it's incredibly exciting. We're here. We are getting the final touches on the site so we can open doors at 4 o'clock today.
I mean, you're literally like kind of building a downtown within a downtown. How many people are you expecting this weekend?
We are. We're building a small city. We are expecting tonight 25,000, and then we will have 40,000 guests with us Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. So over 150,000 people will be coming to Aftershock this weekend.
And you just mentioned Metallica is playing two nights in a row. I've seen them live. They're awesome. They're amazing. And I expect the same this weekend. But you also have Cypress Hill, The Misfits, The Offspring, and Pennywise, which bring me back to high school. I would love to see them live. Machine Gun Kelly. I mean, there's so many artists and headliners. Who are you looking forward to, or what kind of recommendations do you have for people as they're trying to kind of create an itinerary of who they want to see over the weekend?
Yeah, so obviously we have, you know, rock heavyweights, Metallica, you know, doing the two nights, two sets, no song repeated. It is something that they've only done one other time. This will be the second time that they've done this experiment. And so Metallica fans are truly in for a performance that they've never been able to see. This isn't a normal thing for Metallica to do. So that's obviously very exciting. You know, and then we have Gojira, who is, you know, a French band who is gaining in popularity daily over here in the States. We have Mudvayne in their second performance in 12 years. So people are really excited about that. And then, you know, we have some up and comers, Mammoth, WVH, which is, you know, an offspring of Van Halen, grandson. We have, you know, a Widow 7, which was actually a big winner of ours on a month long contest to find out who could open up the festival. And then you have, you know, Rise Against, Mastodon, Suicidal Tendencies. There's really something for everyone.
Yeah, there really is. We just got this question from a fan within the newsroom. Is Metallica celebrating the 30th anniversary of the Black Album?
Metallica is celebrating. I cannot confirm or deny how they will be celebrating it this weekend, but they are celebrating the 30th anniversary of that iconic album.
You know, Aftershock is part of an umbrella company, Danny Wimmer Presents, and I don't think this isn't the first large scale festival you put on this year. I'm just curious if it takes on a different meaning given everything that y'all have endured.
Yeah, this is our third event this year. We have one more in November, and you know, the live event industry, as we all know, is one of the industries that is deeply, deeply affected by the pandemic. And so to not be able to do what we do and work with the bands that we love and entertain the fans in 2020 was heartbreaking for this company. And so, you know, everything in 2021 has been incredibly bittersweet. We are so excited to be here. And, you know, we just cannot wait to open doors because we all missing this for the last 18 months have realized, you know, how important it is to our fans, to our bands, to our team, and how important it is to be providing these jobs and this financial impact to the city of Sacramento. You know, we employ thousands of people throughout the weekend and have an economic revenue of about $30 million into the marketplace. So we are very happy to be back and doing that for the city.
Yeah, I think that really needs to be hit home because not only is there the festival and that's a lot of fun, but I mean, hotels are booked and there's all these restaurants and businesses that are going to benefit from Aftershock after a very tough 18, 19 months. You said that this was the third large scale festival that you're putting on. I mean, we just had Bottle Rock and there's been Lollapalooza. I guess, what are the learning lessons with large scale festivals?
I mean, the biggest learning lesson that we've encountered that is you know, obviously brand new to us is the COVID compliancy. You know, we have a COVID team that we just get more efficient, more effective with every festival because obviously you learn by doing. And so, you know, our COVID team is all here. They have now several large festivals under their belt to make sure that fans, you know, get in as quick as possible. There's not a delay in providing that proof of vaccination or negative test. And, you know, that we can do this as safely as possible. So, you know, that's probably the biggest thing that we're continuing to learn and gain experience in. And, you know, adding this fourth day, this festival is the fourth day for the first time. And so obviously adding that day, you know, brings in, you know, more opportunities for employment, more opportunities for fans to come out and experience it.
Last question. What stands out about Sacramento and Aftershock to you?
You know, Sacramento has been wonderful to Danny Wimmer Presents and to Aftershock. We have an amazing partnership with Visit Sacramento. Mike Testa and his team have, you know, welcomed us with open arms since day one in 2012. And, you know, it's amazing whenever the local tourism, you know, embraces, you know, the idea of bringing a festival in. And they have been amazing partners, as well as the city of Sacramento. You know, we are so thankful for their support. You know, they're here to help us to make sure we have a great experience for all the fans and all of the visitors that are coming in. And, you know, without that, like this festival wouldn't have been able to grow to 4 days and be the, you know, what it will be, the biggest rock festival in America after this weekend.
Wow, that's impressive. Well, there's a headline there. Jamie, thanks so much for joining us and have a great time this weekend.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
That is Jamie McCurry, Chief Marketing Officer with Aftershock Festival. That is it for Insight today. You can learn more about all of our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. In honor of Aftershock Festival, we're going to close out today's show with One by Metallica live at Arco Arena, which is now Sleep Train, back in 1992, so decades ago. Thank you to producer Cynthia Lopez and Pauline Bartoloni, with managing editor Arm Sarkissian. Our digital team is Chris Hagen, Emily Zentner, Helga Salinas, and Megan Minata. Cap Radio's technical director is Mark Jones, and our engineer and music expert, Antonio Munez. Joe Barr is Cap Radio's chief content officer. And I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. We'll catch you back here on Monday.